picture ideas here. And so before we do that, Jeff, would you lead us in a word of prayer?
Dear Heavenly Father, we thank you for this another beautiful Lord's Day that you've given us. We thank you for bringing us together this morning. We ask that we may focus our minds and our hearts upon you and Jesus and your word. Please, Father, always be with us. Guide us in our daily lives. Help us to always remember you and Jesus and put your word first and realize that as we are out in the world that we are shining a light and we need to shine and do the best we can to represent and be the best Christians that we can be. Be with us this day, Father, and continually always. In Christ's name we pray. Amen.
Okay, so here in Matthew chapter 24, whenever we look at these passages, we always want to delve deep into these things, but for the sake of time, we're going to hit the big picture of what's going on here in Matthew 24 and 25. If you remember, in Matthew 23, Jesus had pronounced the woes upon the Pharisees and scribes. And he is basically showing that on the outside, they may appear to be righteous and godly, that everything they have everything going on, but their hearts are far from God. And so he pronounces these eight different woes. And then we come to verse 37. Notice what Jesus says here. As you get this idea, this imagery that he's looking out over Jerusalem. In verse 37, Jesus says, "Jerusalem, Jerusalem, who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her. How often I wanted to gather your children together the way a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were unwilling. Behold, your house is being left to you desolate. For I say to you, from now on you will not see me until you say, 'Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord.'" And so you get this great imagery here that Jesus is looking out over Jerusalem and he's saying, "I wanted to gather you together for so long under my wings, like a chick gathers her, a hen gathers her chicks, but you were unwilling." In verse 38, "Behold, your house is being left to you desolate." And that phrase really is going to spark what's going to happen here in chapter 24, where Jesus leaves the temple. His disciples in verse 1 are looking up at the temple buildings and they say, verse 2, Jesus said to them, "Do you not see all these things? Truly I say to you, not one stone here will be left upon another which will not be torn down." The disciples are looking at the elaborate structure of the temple and Jesus says, "It's all going to be torn down. One stone will not be left upon another." And from this point on, throughout the rest of much of the rest of chapter 24, Jesus is going to describe the destruction of the temple, the destruction of Jerusalem, in very apocalyptic language. Sometimes I think when we read this chapter, we're kind of baffled by the language. It's hard to really grasp what's going on sometimes. But I think it's important to recognize that it is not only apocalyptic, but there's also a lot of language here that's drawn from the Old Testament. Because this chapter ties back to Old Testament prophecy. And I think one of the reasons we struggle with these passages sometimes is because we aren't as familiar with the Old Testament as maybe we ought to be. And I think Old Testament prophecy, sometimes we think, well, the Old Testament isn't really that big of a deal because we're under the New Testament today. But I think with that way of thinking, we're missing out that all of these Old Testament prophecies from Daniel and the prophets and all these things are the foundation for what we read here in Matthew 24 and other passages as well. And so that's important for us to remember. In fact, here in this chapter, Jesus mentions one of the prophets. Who does he mention here? If you read through this chapter already, but perhaps is there a passage that
Daniel in 15?
Yeah, Daniel in verse 15. who mentions this whole idea about the abomination of desolation. For those of you who've been in the Daniel class, you probably know something about that. But all that goes back to Daniel chapter 9, where Daniel has this vision of 70 weeks, which, from what I understand, is kind of a symbolic number that spans the time frame from the rebuilding of Jerusalem and the temple all the way through the time of the destruction of Jerusalem. And within that passage in Daniel chapter 9, you see this imagery of a ruler who's going to come in and destroy Jerusalem, that kind of thing. And so that's the whole concept of this abomination of desolation, where this Gentile ruler, specifically probably a Roman, the Romans come and desecrate the temple and destroy Jerusalem. And so, while there's a lot there to that passage, I think the whole overarching point here is that Jesus is showing that all of these passages were all really looking forward to this in that way. That Jerusalem is going to be destroyed just like Daniel had spoken about in other prophets. And so that's the whole idea. But why? Let me ask you this question. Why is the temple in Jerusalem being destroyed? Why is all that happening?
Because they killed the prophets.
They killed the prophets. Specifically, they're going to be judged because they've rejected Jesus as well, rejected the Messiah who's right in front of them. And so that's kind of the beginning points here, the foundation that lays forth the rest of the chapter. Let's look at verse 3. Let's just read here, verses 3 through 31. Matthew 24, verse 3. It says, "As he was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, 'Tell us, when will these things happen, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?' And Jesus answered and said to them, See to it that no one misleads you. For many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and will mislead many. You will be hearing of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not frightened, for those things must take place, but that is not yet the end. For nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. In various places there will be famines and earthquakes, but all these things are merely the beginning of birth pangs. Then they will deliver you to tribulation, and will kill you, and you will be hated by all nations because of my name. At that time many will fall away, and will betray one another, and hate one another. Many false prophets will arise and will mislead many. Because lawlessness is increased, most people's love will grow cold. But the one who endures to the end, he will be saved. The gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all the nations, and then the end will come. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, let the reader understand. Then those who are in Judea must flee to the mountains. Whoever is on the housetop must not go down to get the things out that are in his house. Whoever is in the field must not turn back to get his cloak. But woe to those who are pregnant and those who are nursing babies in those days. But pray that your flight will not be in winter or on a Sabbath. For then there will be a great tribulation, such as not occurred since the beginning of the world until now, nor ever will. Unless those days had been cut short, no life would have been saved. But for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short. Then if anyone says to you, 'Behold, here is the Christ,' or 'There he is,' do not believe him. For false Christs and false prophets will arise and will show great signs and wonders, so as to mislead, if possible, even the elect. Behold, I have told you in advance. So if they say to you, 'Behold, he is in the wilderness,' do not go out. Or 'Behold, he is in the inner rooms,' do not believe them. For just as the lightning comes from the east and flashes even to the west, so will the coming of the Son of Man be. Wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. But immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from the sky, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. And then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn. And they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. And he will send forth his angels with a great trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of the sky to the other." Okay, I know that was a long passage, but I wanted to get that in our minds. Here is Jesus' response to the disciples' questions. He is sitting on the Mount of Olives. His disciples say, "Tell us, when will these things happen and what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age? When they ask Jesus about the sign of his coming, what does that refer to? What do you think? What's he talking about there, about the sign of his coming? When you think about the Old Testament,
there's always signs. There's always something physical preceding the event, I guess you'd say.
Yeah, when you think about the Old Testament, how was the Lord depicted in coming? You think about any passages that kind of demonstrate that thought?
Like when Elijah was called up, I mean, there was always like splendor and glory.
Sure.
To those events.
Yeah, I think so. We kind of read a little bit about this kind of language. Verse 30, the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. What do you think that idea presents? What's the message there? Yeah, I think it is judgment. I think it's a language of judgment. That God, when he comes, is judging his enemies. What is so shocking about that here, then? We often think about God judging his enemies, right? You think about God judging Babylon or Assyria, but who is being mentioned here?
The Jews.
That would have been shocking, I think. That here the Jews are being described as being judged, as we talked about, for their rejection. And so despite here in verse 37 through 39 of Jesus wanting to gather them up, they rejected him. And so Jesus says, your house is going to be left desolate. What are some of your thoughts here from this whole section? What stands out to you here?
He tells them about the persecution that they're going to have to endure.
Okay.
About what they're going to have to be up against after he's gone, but that they've got to stay the course.
Okay, yeah, definitely. Jesus is emphasizing over and over that this destruction is going to happen, and he says, don't let anybody mislead you. He says, there are going to be some who come along and say, I'm the Christ, or there he is, go out to him in the wilderness. And I don't know if we've ever thought about this before, but this was kind of pointed out to me. If you were to put yourself in the Jewish mind, in the Jewish setting for a moment, when the people thought about the Christ, what did they think about? Were they thinking about Jesus, or were they thinking about something else?
They always had an earthly kingdom in mind.
Okay, they thought about the fact that the Messiah would come and establish this physical kingdom, and he would do that by destroying the Romans. And so I think Jesus is saying here that there are going to be times that are so desperate, as Jim is talking about here, that people are going to start these rumors saying that the Christ is here, there's going to be deliverance. But Jesus is showing that the Romans are going to come, they're going to destroy Jerusalem. And so don't be misled, don't be deceived by what people are saying. And there's going to be persecution that happens. It's going to get so bad that people betray one another, people's love grows cold. There's going to be this false teaching and apostasy. Some will fall away. And so all of that language is describing what's going to happen to Jerusalem. What else do you notice here?
To Stephen's point, when the time does come, nobody's going to know when that comes. I mean, amongst all of what's going on, there's going to be different things that are going to be going on when this judgment comes.
Okay, looking at that in verse 15, you have that kind of language that goes throughout the rest of this section where he mentions this whole idea of the abomination of desolation. And I think that was supposed to be a sign to the disciples that when they saw the Gentiles coming in and invading the land, the Romans coming, and they were to flee, as he says. Let the reader understand those who were in Judea must flee to the mountains. That was a sign to get out of the city. What's interesting is that historically speaking, there were no Christians who ever killed as a result of that. When they saw all this taking place, they left the city, and it was the Jewish people who were destroyed. And so they saved their lives in that way. But as you kind of think about that, do you think a normal Jew would be, as they saw all this happening, do you think that their natural reaction would be to flee or to run? What do you think their natural reaction would be?
Are you asking what their reaction should be, or what their reaction would be in light of their wickedness and their alignment with the Romans and all their evil?
Yeah, the latter.
Well, they would try to buddy up to the Romans.
Yeah, I think their natural reaction would be to try to protect the city that they're living in, to fight, to lean on God to rescue them and so forth. But over and over throughout this chapter, Jesus is showing that Jerusalem is going to be destroyed. There's nothing that's going to stop that. And so those who refuse to leave are going to be destroyed. What else do you notice here in this section, or this passage?
That's the chick. The chick's returning to its hen, by the way. And typically when there's a little bit of danger, the chick's going, you know, straight to the mother.
Okay.
And so that's where Christ is saying, you're not like that.
Okay, good thought. Good observation. And think about that. What else here?
Lightning from the east is a really interesting statement.
Okay.
From what I understand, the blessings of God came from the east. God emanated from the east. And we typically would think of that in a good, positive sense. But in here, that's coming judgment from the east.
Mm-hmm.
To a Jewish ear, that would be pretty powerful.
Yeah. That's a good point. You see kind of the main idea here, though, of what we're looking at? I hope we're not lost in all the details here, but Jesus is showing over and over throughout this section that nothing is going to stop this destruction. It's coming. In fact, in verse 34, Jesus emphasizes this by saying, "Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away." Almost hyperbole, showing that as unlikely as it would be of heaven and earth passing away, my words aren't going to pass away. This is coming. And so, and in fact, as you kind of think about just a historical timeline of the destruction of Jerusalem, of what all took place, we know that in AD 66, that the Jewish war with Rome broke out in Galilee. Nero is the emperor at that time, and he sends Vespasian, who comes and fights the Jews. And in AD 69, Nero dies, and Vespasian becomes emperor. And in AD 70, Vespasian sends his son Titus to lead Roman forces to destroy Jerusalem. And in August of AD 70, Jerusalem is finally destroyed. In fact, that's a temple of, or that's a picture of an arch that Domitian, the brother of Titus, erected for his brother, that kind of showed the spoils of the war of Jerusalem. And in fact, here is a depiction of them carrying off the temple vessels and all those things. So that's just kind of a historical imagery of what had happened in the destruction of Jerusalem. And so you kind of see that idea. But that's kind of a big picture of what's going on here in Matthew 24. Is there any other questions that you have about this section? There's clearly more that we can talk about here.
Yeah, so, I mean, what are the disciples thinking about all this at the time that it's going on? As you get over even into 26, after he completes his discourse, and then he tells them that it's just going to be a few days till my time's going to come. How are they processing all this?
That is a good question. I mean, I think they have some idea of what's going on. I don't know, though. I mean, I don't know exactly.
But you get into 26 and he tells them what's going to happen, and then he starts complaining, or they start complaining when this woman uses this oil to show her respects to him. And they're saying, hey, that should have been spent and put in the drink. So, I mean, it's easy for us to look back and say, you know, how did they know because of what we had to look at, but.
Sure. Yeah, that's a good thought.
Well, at the Garden of Gethsemane, remember, he chastises them for being asleep, you know, and tells them, be ready. And I think that kind of stresses that point as well, you know. I mean, we all get fatigued, I'm not saying that. But he's kind of like, the time's here, you know, quit sleeping, get to duty here.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, what's the takeaway for us? I mean, from a standpoint of, I mean, how many of us live our lives every day with the thought that this life's going to come to an end one day?
Well,
this world, you know, that Christ is going to come again and we better be ready. Do we think about that? Or are we worried about, you know, making our house payment and,
sure.
You know, I'm stressed at my work and my job and, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and I'm certainly, that's my plan to get into some of that as the text goes on. And that is a valid question, that's a valid point to think about, and how ready are we, how alert are we, watchful, that kind of thing. And I want to talk more about that as the text goes on.
Didn't mean to jump.
No, that's okay. No, that's a good point, a good observation, something we need to be mindful of. And so, here, I think it is important to notice that here at the beginning, that the destruction of Jerusalem is foremost in the mind of Jesus. And then, as this text goes on, and throughout the rest of 25, we're going to see this language of the Lord's second coming, of the final judgment, and those things are really important for us to be thinking about. Verse 32, we see this kind of parable of the fig tree, and Jesus tells this parable. If you've ever been to Palestine, I've never been, but from what I understand, Palestine is well known for having fig trees. And one of the things that people really anticipated was the summer fruit. They eagerly awaited that. And Jesus is using that idea to show that in the same way you see the branches coming forth on this fig tree, and that shows the summer fruit is near. In the same way, all these things I've described to you, you'll know that judgment is about to take place as all these things are happening. And so, again, we talked about the certainty of all of that. I think in verse 36, Jesus is going to start a new section, a new thought, where he turns from talking about the destruction of Jerusalem and talks about his second coming, this final judgment that's going to permeate the rest of the chapter. There's some contextual clues that show that. Jesus starts talking, he's been talking about those days, and now he talks about a specific day and hour that nobody knows. And so, here's a big picture of what's going to go on throughout this next whole section. In verses 24, verses 36-42, we're going to see this kind of unexpected nature of Jesus' return compared to the days of Noah. And then in verses 43 through 25 and verse 30, we're going to see these parables of preparedness. You've got the householder and the thief, the faithful and unfaithful servants, the 10 virgins, the parable of the talents. And then finally at the end, we're going to see this description of the final judgment. Those three parables, the first three parables there, are all connected together. And they all emphasize the point that Jesus, or Jim was making about being prepared at all times, being ready. And the parable of the talents then are going to describe what that preparation involves, being good stewards of what God has given us with the time that we have. And so, it would be impossible for us to go throughout all of these sections and read them. And so what I want to do is give the big picture, some of the main ideas that occur throughout the rest of this section. And the first one is this concept of preparedness, this idea of watchfulness. When you think about that idea, what comes to your mind? What do you think about when it comes to being prepared and watchful?
Well,
truly living our lives for Christ, that would keep us prepared.
Yeah, definitely. You see all this language throughout the Bible, right? Of being alert, being sober-minded, being awake. Sometimes it's easy to think about that in terms of being in a constant state of red alert. You think about movies. You've ever seen movies that kind of show this idea of being on red alert. You got paperwork spread out all over the ground. You got people rushing here and there. Is that what Jesus is talking about here? And on the other hand, is Jesus saying we just need to quit our jobs and just live our lives expecting, waiting for his return? I think about the example of the Thessalonians who just stopped living, stopped working, and were waiting for his return. What's the idea here? Yes.
I think it's about everything we've studied up to this point that he's taught during his entire ministry. And it's that, you know, our lives every day should be a cumulative reflection of everything we're trying to do to live with the character of Christ, so that when that day does come, we're going to be ready and we're not going to be surprised.
Right.
And it's not going to matter because the things that matter have mattered. Instead of getting caught up in the law like the Pharisees did, and we've made what matters the most important thing. We've tried to live our lives the way that the Lord expects us to. We've shown love and compassion and tried to put him first and then our care for everybody else right behind that.
Yeah.
And if we're not doing that, then we need to examine how prepared we are when that day does come.
Definitely.
You know, this is really a powerful section in Matthew. Mm-hmm. You know, and I have to ask myself this question. Why did God see fit to record that for us, because it was to the Jews, right?
Certainly.
So why did he see fit that we should read it also? So,
yeah.
And he put it in our word, and he put it in the Bible.
Yeah.
And that makes Bill Cobb think, you know, I need to pay attention to this too, because we're living that right now. We're living, this world is full of false prophets right now that are pulling some Christians away even into their beliefs. And this is, we're actually living some of the descriptions that is portrayed in that section right there, and that you're continuing on right now under preparedness, because that really rings the bell right there. Preparedness is a great question.
Yeah.
That's a question we have to ask ourselves. Are we prepared?
Yeah.
And, you know, Jesus Christ in the whole chapter before kind of give us a view of what we need to do to be prepared.
Very much so.
And stay focused on him.
Yeah, you see, this whole idea, as you all have been talking about, is just this whole idea of living a life that's ready to meet the Lord. That's what it's all about, everything that we've been talking about. And what's interesting is you look at these parables, you see a great contrast, right? You see a contrast between such as the five virgins who were foolish, didn't take any oil, those who were unprepared, between those who were prepared and got to go in and enter into the marriage feast, the wedding feast. And so that's what Jesus is trying to get across to us, is just be prepared, be ready. But why is that so difficult for us? Why do we struggle with that? Why do we lose sight of this idea of being prepared and ready, living a life that's ready to meet him?
Satan.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, I was going to say, we get complacent. And preparedness isn't not just an idea new here. It's all throughout the Bible, from Noah.
Right.
To Paul, who tells Timothy he's being poured out as a drink offering. It's an element all through the Bible that we have to be prepared. But we get complacent, we get comfortable, and we think tomorrow's going to be like today. And we all know that the reality is that it may not. But and Jesus is trying to give us a reality check here.
Yeah. Somebody else had their hand.
Well, I kind of was thinking, it's such an abstract idea, I guess, for lack of a better term, that we always think that there's going to be, it did fall off. Also, the preparedness of like natural disasters, California, earthquake, top 3 days of water, always, you know, or like a modern day prepper, I guess, top 3 days of water, have batteries, have 3 days worth of food for that, for the, when the big one hits, which how many of us or, you know, tornadoes or whatever, have that actually ready? We don't. The majority of us don't. So it's like being prepared spiritually. I don't, the majority of the world is not prepared.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's...
And you just never know when it's going to happen.
It's easy to, that, for that mentality to work itself in our lives, too. I think a lot of the times we just get so caught up in the day-to-day things in life. Jim talked about mortgage payments or just different things of going to work and all those kinds of things. We just get drowsy and sleep sometimes, like the ten virgins did, and we lose sight of what really matters.
You know, we have a preview of that when Moses was up on the mountain. How quick children of Israel had turned away. You know, I mean, that was just, you know, God created us with a mind of choice. We can have choices on anything in this world. But, you know, like the children of Israel, I mean, Moses was up there for a short time, and they were building a golden calf. So, you know, to say we're different, yeah, maybe we are because we've got the Bible and we study and you know, we're maybe more involved in it than they was, but still, that shows that inner man, too, how quick he can get away. Because that's what's important about being in this class this morning, being in services on Wednesday night, anytime we have an opportunity, to keep us faithful and strong. I'm talking about for me.
Sure.
A follower of Christ.
Definitely. So, Yeah. Very good point. It's easy to get sidetracked.
I like the idea of preparedness being an abstract thought. I think that really kind of puts it in context with regard to how we think about the judgment. I mean, because it really is, I mean, if we don't give it some thought, it is very abstract. Yeah. And our lives probably sometimes reflect that. That we don't believe it.
Yeah.
It's real.
Yeah. Good point. The other concept that I thought about here within these different parables is the concept of stewardship. You certainly see that here with the parable of the talents. And we don't have time to read all of that, but I want to talk about some of the things here. Hopefully you've read that already. Let me ask you this, how does the concept of stewardship relate to the idea of preparedness, waiting for the Lord's return? How do those two things connect together?
We're using what talents that we've been given to prepare ourselves. You know, share the word.
Stewardship means we've been entrusted with something. Well, we've been entrusted with sharing God's word.
Right.
That's part of the preparedness, is sharing God's word so that others can be aware, know what needs to be done, what's coming, and for them to be prepared.
Yeah, that's kind of the whole idea here. This concept of stewardship runs throughout the parable of the talents. And as Jesus speaks about the talents, he's talking about this kind of monetary figure. A talent was worth about 15 years of wages for a laborer. But that's what he's talking about throughout this whole parable, is that God entrusted these different people with different things according to their ability, and they were supposed to do something with it. And so that concept of stewardship permeates our life as well. As you mentioned, the whole idea of evangelism, but it goes beyond that, I think, with how we use our money, how we use our time, different things like that that permeate our lives, that tie into this idea of being prepared for the Lord's return. What are some of the concepts here of stewardship that you notice throughout this parable?
I just think it's one of the concepts, and it's hard for us to relate, is not everybody's equal in talent.
Right.
And that is not discrimination. That is just a fact of life. And I'm not as smart as Jim, and I'm not as smart as other people or you, but there's nothing, no shame in that. That's why I take what God gave me, I make the most out of it, and I glorify Him. That's what He's wanting us to do. And that makes me, in His eyes, just as valuable as somebody with 10 talents. And I meant that as a compliment to all y'all that mentioned my name. But that's what it is. It is value. Jesus values us on what we can contribute, not on how much we have to contribute.
Yeah, that's a good point. Certainly, as this parable emphasizes, that God gave the talents to these stewards according to their ability, and expecting them to be doing something with them. What else do you notice about stewardship that runs through this parable? Or just things that you notice about this parable?
I've thought about this parable a lot.
Well, just thoughts that you have.
Okay. The last man, all right? I think it's human nature for us, for me anyway, to feel sympathy for somebody that's fearful. The reason that the last man did nothing with his talent was he was afraid. Mm-hmm. His fear caused him to be paralyzed.
Yeah.
That's the way I kind of look at it.
Yeah, no, I think so.
How does the Lord look at it, though? What did He call it? Slothful, evil, took all that He had. And I think if you look at it from God's perspective, being fearful is so akin, as you'll find in Revelation, that the first two people mentioned that won't make it into heaven are the fearful and the unbelieving. If you have faith, like you should have faith, then fear will not paralyze you, right? Because if you believe it with all your heart, you're going to move on.
Yeah.
This man didn't have enough faith, so it stopped him dead in his tracks.
Yeah. We definitely see that idea here.
Again, I thought about it, like I say, I drive a truck for a living, so I have a lot of time to think.
Sure.
Fear can be a great motivator. There are a lot of things that you and I may do because we're afraid. We're afraid of consequences, what could happen if I don't. Fear can also, in this situation, can be paralyzing.
Yeah.
I'm afraid, so I'm not going to do anything.
Yeah.
That kind of fear will cause each and every one of us to lose our soul.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's kind of a two-sided coin there.
It is.
I think what stands out to me here throughout this parable is not only did the master entrust these people with talents according to their own ability, but he expected them to be doing something with them. He expects us to be using what He's been giving us. And those who gain more talents are rewarded, and the one, as you mentioned, who didn't do anything, but let fear paralyze him from doing anything, was not rewarded. And so I guess the concluding question in all of this, although there's more we can talk about, is what are we doing with what God has given us? What are we doing with the things that God has entrusted to us? That's a very powerful concept, that God has entrusted something to us. And we have to be willing to do something with that. What are we doing with His word? What are we doing with His time? Those kinds of things. And how will He find us? That's really the question, too, is when the Lord returns, what will He find us doing? Being faithful or unfaithful stewards? And that's a pretty sobering thought to think about. Anything else there?
Yeah, I think it's just when we look at how we use our time on a daily basis, on a weekly basis, on a whatever basis, when we look at how we use our time.
Yeah.
Are we really investing any time in our relationship with God? And I'm not talking about coming to the worship service. I'm talking right. about what we're doing otherwise to try and build and develop our character. From time that we spend with each other, to encourage each other, to challenge each other, to try and better understand what our weaknesses are and how we can grow. To try to help other people, trying to do the things that are a reflection of what really matters. And again, I think it's so easy to get caught up in everything else that's going on that it gets no time. And we, if that's where we are unprepared.
I want to look at one last point here, kind of close all this out, and that's Jesus' standard for judgment within this last description of Jesus picturing the final judgment. Let me ask you this question. Have you ever wondered how you would have reacted to seeing Jesus in the flesh? Would you have welcomed him or rejected him? Would you have been willing to follow him if he called you to follow him? And as Jesus describes his final scene of judgment, he kind of gives us the answer to that. He is depicted as sitting on his glorious throne, and he separates the sheep from the goats. And the sheep enter into the kingdom because they saw Jesus in need and provided for him. And the goats are sentenced to eternity away from him because they did nothing to provide for him when he was in need. And when both of these groups hear this, they respond in confusion. Lord, when did we see you in need? When did we take care of you? And Jesus says, to the extent that you did it to one of the least of my brothers, you did it to me. And so the standard for which we'll be judged is by our deeds. And so Jesus is showing here throughout this that when we serve one another, we in turn are actually serving him. And so Jesus is showing over and over that I was all around you. Every need that you encountered, every downcast face, every broken heart, those who were invited in and did something were those who were rewarded. And so that's kind of the idea that he's talking about within this last section. Thank you for your comments. Thank you for your thoughts. We'll pick up in chapter 26 on Wednesday.
Thank you.
You're welcome.